two-part series. Ian will bring up the rear. What we're trying to do, together with a graduate student called Stephanie Erickson, is to come up with a general extension of this sort of well-known Valencia framework for GR, MHD, hydro, to include elasticity. And I'll be talking mostly about the sort of mathematical side of things and the general motivation. So, well, obviously, all neutron stars have crust, and that's the physics we have in mind. I won't say very much about it, about that. So obviously we have star quakes, we have these QPOs that Pablo has just talked about. We have these short gamma ray burst precursors that David Tsang has talked about. There may be other things to do. How much of that in the end is necessary, we don't know. But there are other reasons for including this. So all modern fluid codes are high resolution shock capturing, and they're based on solving Riemann problems. And so if you want to include magnetic effects, it's perhaps not a good idea. Sorry, elastic effects. We don't really want to make them a lot, sort of linear and let them sit on top of something completely different. We want to incorporate them straight away, and that is probably the easiest approach. And also, elasticity-like fluids admits weak solutions. I'll talk about those in some detail because they may not be familiar. And so we want to be able to simulate those things. Now, there are Newtonian codes from industrial applications which can handle weak solutions. The sort of best effort is by Miller and Colella over a number of papers. And in GR code, as far as I'm aware, everything is where elasticity is used. It's linear elasticity, and there's no weak solutions, no discontinuous solutions. So Pablo has talked about his work there. From the beginning, we want to restrict to what's technically called hyperelasticity. In other words, the material remembers its unsheared state, but it doesn't remember how it got there. So that means there is no hysteresis or plasticity. Those could be added, but we don't know if they're important. So let me talk about just the kinematics, the matter variables. So we're using essentially the framework that goes back to a paper by Carter and Quintana, 1972. That's a generalization of the general framework of Carter for relativistic fluids, which is very widely used. So the basic idea is, where are the matter particles? To remember what the unsheared state was, we basically have to know where the particles are. If I take a fluid at a moment of time and I shuffle all the particles around, but I leave, you know, the pressure, the entropy, the density the same, then it doesn't make any difference, right? I can basically relabel the particles in a fluid. If I do that for elasticity, it would make a difference. In other words, if I take a rubber block and I shear it, and then I cut the edges off to make it square again, it's still a sheared rubber block, right? So it knows that it has been sheared. Okay, so the mathematical framework for this is, you need to know where the particles are. So you have a map from each space-time point to a point on the matter space, X3. So X3 is just a sort of abstract space that labels the matter. So if the matter is a spherical shell, that would have a topology of a spherical shell. And into coordinates, we go from four space-time coordinates, XA, to three space coordinates, XiA. And being relativists, of course, we allow arbitrary coordinates on space-time and arbitrary coordinates on matter space. So small indices are space-time indices, large indices are matter space indices. And because we want a first-order discontinuous formulation, we will use the first derivatives of that map, dxia by dxa, as our primary variable. So this object is called the configuration in the language of the field, and this is called the configuration gradient. Unfortunately, the terminology is very confused in the Newtonian literature, but this is the one we like best. So first notice that because, by definition, particle world lines are tangent to the four velocity. That means that the derivative of these coordinates along the particle four velocity is zero. And so, in other words, this object has to vanish. So basically, if we know what the four velocity is, we only need to know 9 out of the 12 components of this object. In other words, if I parameterize the four velocity in this way by three velocity v hat, alpha is the lapse, w is the Lorentz factor, but that's not important. then I know what the time components of this object are in terms of the space components. So I will effectively use the three velocity, which is the same as in hydro, and the configuration gradient, the spatial part of it, 3 by 3, as my primary variables. And I can always reconstruct the 4 by 3 from the free velocity. Okay. The kinematics are very, very simple, although when you read the Newtonian literature, they manage to make it very complicated because they don't understand differential geometry. Remember, these are psi AA is the first derivative. So if we take another derivative, anti-symmetrize, that's just vanishing because partial derivatives commute. That's all there is to it. Now, that's a space-time equation. We can split that into a space part and a time part. The space part is constraints. The time parts is evolution equations for these 9 objects, psi AA. I also need evolution equations for the free velocity, but that's going to be given by stress energy conservation, as in hydro. So I'll come back to that a few slides down. So we have constraints and evolution equations for these first order kinematic matter variables for configuration gradient. Let me point out that these the constraints are conserved by the evolution equations. You can almost do that in your head. You would expect it, of course. These equations are in conservation law form. This is a conservation law with no time derivative part, but it's still a conservation law. And this is a conservation law as well, as you can see. So we are already set up to do weak solutions, as in hydro. And, well, if we have conservation laws and we want to look at weak solutions, then effectively we go through the integral form of those conservation laws, and then better take the correct integral form because different integral forms are inequivalent in terms of weak solutions, as is well known. So we need to be sure that we understand physically what the weak solutions of these conservation laws mean. And we can do that by checking what the jump conditions, the Rankine-Hogan-Yau conditions are. And that is what I want to do pictorially. So I won't go through the mathematics. I'll just show you pictures. And hopefully those will make sense to those people in the audience who don't know relativity because they're quite intuitive. So I'm going to show you 4 pictures. There is 2 types of the time-independent constraints, and this is the first type. So let's assume I've chosen for simplicity the discontinuity here. This is x, this is y, and I've aligned in the left state the matter and the space coordinates. It's just for the purpose of drawing a picture. So this grid here shows me the matter coordinates. It doesn't mean I have a cubic lattice or anything. It's just a way of showing where the particles are. This is not allowed. This would be a discontinuity of the derivative of capital Y with respect to little y, and that's forbidden by one of the jump conditions. And what does it mean? It means we can't do this kind of surgery where we have sort of cut apart the block of rubber, compressed one side of it, and glued it back together again. That's not allowed. I mean, physically, you could do such an experiment, but you wouldn't expect that to happen unless you break the crystal during a time evolution. There's a second class of constraints, still time independent, which is this. So again, you've broken the block, and you sort of planed off an edge, and then you glued it back together again. And this corresponds to the derivative of capital X with respect to capital Y being discontinuous. That's not allowed. So those are the constraints. They have perfect physical meaning, and therefore be justified in using their weak forms, using their integral forms. Notice that this is all kinematic. I'm not really talking about densities here or stresses yet or anything. It's just saying we basically, if we paint a crystal lattice on, which doesn't have to be the physical one, but if we paint a crystal lattice on the crystal initially, that crystal lattice has to stay continuous. We can't cut and paste it during the evolution. Same thing for the matter world lines. The matter world lines can't be discontinuous. There can't be any teleportation. So there's 2 kinds of dynamical jump conditions. This is familiar from hydro. So for, again, I'm identifying coordinates to make the picture easy to look at. Again, this is the discontinuity. And basically, the matter has to move more slowly on the left because it's denser. On the right, it's thinner, and therefore it has to move faster. Right? So that's perfectly well known from hydro. What's not so well known from hydro is a different kind of jump condition, and it's this. I can call this a shear shock. So if you had a left state and a right state, and you just move, try to move the left state against the right state tangentially to the shock, well, that would be just a contact discontinuity hydro. You could just take two fluid blocks where the pressure is continuous and just slide them along each other with arbitrary relative velocity. Now, with a block of rubber, you can't do that. So what would happen? Think about this as some kind of, you know, one of these metal tape measures that come on a spool. So they kink quite easily. So you have it laid out here, and then it comes up here, and I pull this up. Well, there will be a kink traveling along the ground. Yes. So in other words, if I take the right state and I just pull it up, that's possible because that kink will move left. And it's again pure kinematics to relate the speed at which I pull up the right state to the speed with which that kink travels into the left state. And again, it's just the continuity of the crystal lattice. Okay, so that's basically the weak form of the kinematic conservation laws, which are new. Let me talk a little bit about the geometric structure on the matter space, X3. What do we need? Well, we need to be able to count particles, so we need at least a volume form. Remember, this is a three-dimensional space, so the volume form has three indices. Totally anti-symmetric tensor. We also want a conformal metric, which allows us to measure angles, because obviously if you want to shear the crystal and measure that, we need to be able to measure angles between crystal axes. So we need a conformal metric. But of course, if we have a volume form and a conformal metric, we have a full metric. So without further loss of generality, I can assume we have a metric KAB, which is different from the space-time metric. It's something that lives on the matter space and therefore is time-independent. Now, in the Newtonian literature, people always assume two things. First, they assume that this metric is flat, and then they further assume that we use Cartesian coordinates in matter space so that this metric is just given by the unit matrix. Now, none of these things are natural in GR, and I'll talk about the flatness approximation later. So that will turn out to be wrong in GR. And also, if you want to have hot equations of state, we need to have something like the entropy or temperature, and that is basically a property of the matter because, of course, in ideal hydrodynamics, in smooth solutions, the entropy is just a vector, so we can just put that on matter space as a scalar for the purpose of this formulation. So this is probably the worst transparency in terms of mathematics, but I just wanted to show you something entirely. How do we get the conserved particle number flux out of this framework? So we don't need to, of course, in the Valencia formulation of hydro, you have a conserved particle number current, and you write that in conservation law form. Everybody's ever done hydro knows about that. That is for us as redundant because the evolution of the psi's, the psi AA, contains, out of those nine components, one of them is basically the particle number density. Let me show you that. So we have this volume form in matter space, which is time independent. We pull it back via this map to a free form on space-time. We also have on space-time the volume form that comes from the space-time metric, which has four indices. We contract those two, we get a current. And we can, write that as a density times the four velocity. It's easy to see this must be proportional to the four velocity. I'm not showing the calculation, but it's straightforward. And one can also easily show that this is conserved. Now, if I write that in the usual Valencia variables in terms of the 3 plus 1 split, then this particle number density on a time slice is given by the determinant of the map. That's what the Newtonian people use as well. But then it's also the determinant of the matter metric, the determinant of the spatial metric at that of that time slice, and the Lorentz factor of the matter with respect to the observer's normal to the time slice. So the Newtonian limit is just this factor here, because the Newtonian people assume that this is has unit determinant and this has unit determinant. The GR formula is that. So throughout this talk, I'm not talking about the Newtonian limit, but there's always a perfect Newtonian limit for everything I say. Okay, now I want to talk about stress energy conservation. So as said before, we have these nine objects, psi AI, the configuration gradient. We have evolution equations and constraints for them. Out of those nine, one of them components is the density. And we therefore need the stress energy conservation to update the energy effectively, or the temperature, or the entropy. And we need also three of those components to update the velocity. And I'm going to show you how to do that now. So the best way of defining a stress energy tensor and relativity, of course, is to vary in action with respect to the metric. So let's write the action. This is, all goes back to Carter and Quintana. So we have an action, we have a Lagrangian. I call it E, will be apparent in a moment why I call it that, but for now that's just an action. Sorry, a Lagrangian. And it's a function of the space-time metric, the matter-space metric, the entropy that I mentioned earlier, and the configuration gradient. Okay, now that looks complicated, but immediately one sees that this Lagrangian must be a scalar, both on space-time and on matter-space. So we have a lot of geometric structure here, and we can use that. And in very pedestrian terms, how can we get scalars? Well, we certainly can't have any free indices. So we have a space-time index here and a space-time index here. And the only way we can contract them is this. So we have now got rid of the space-time indices, and we have this object. Technically, this is the push forward of a space-time metric onto the matter space at a point in space-time. So this depends both on the space-time and the matter space. So we have this object. And so basically, instead of those two, we have that. So we've already simplified the action. Now I can take the derivative of this action with respect to the metric, and I get the stress energy tensor, and I use the chain rule, and I take a derivative with respect to that, and then use the chain rule. And after some calculation, it turns out the stress energy tensor has this form. E is that, so it turns out that on shell, the Lagrangian evaluates to be the total energy density. U is the four velocity as defined earlier, so it's defined by the size. And then there is a stress tensor, which I'll talk about in a moment. But you see this is a block diagonal thing, so there is no mixed component between that and that. PAB is normal to U because it can be written as a partial derivative of the energy. This is, I'm writing the total energy density as rest mass energy plus thermal energy. And you can see this is the pullback of this object onto space-time, and by definition, it's therefore normal to the four velocity. So in other words, the stress energy tensor is block diagonal, just like the stress energy tensor of perfect fluid, which means there's no heat flux. Yes, Larry? Oh, yes, thank you. Okay, so I can move on, I think. Right, let me quickly talk about isotropic matter, which is what we're mostly interested in. Isotropic means not that it hasn't got preferred directions after we've sheared it, but that it's isotropic when it's still unsheared. Okay, so we've reduced our action to this. Now, how do we get scalars out of this? Well, the only thing we can do is we can contract this object like that. Now we have an object with one index up, one index down. That's a linear map or a matrix. And therefore, its eigenvalues are coordinate independent. So we have three eigenvalues of this 3x3 matrix. And their product, in other words, the determinant of this object is the density again. That's not obvious, but it turns out to be true. And we can take two of the other eigenvalues. And let me call them I1 and I2. And then I can write the first law in this form. So I have the epsilon, the internal energy, per particle, is TdS minus PdV. And then I have these two generalized forces and these two generalized displacements. So that's the equation of state we will be using. Okay. So what about freezing? How do I set KAB, the metaspace metric? Well, in the unsheared state, by definition, this is the density times the unit matrix. So I can use that to initialize KAB at freezing. Notice that KAB is basically a sort of imprint of the spatial metric of the time of freezing. And so therefore, it can't be flat. Even if we're in flat space-time, the fact that this depends on the Lorentz factor means that it will be in general not flat. And after freezing, well, this lives on matter space, so it's time dependent, so it just gets invected as a space-time scalar. So the evolution is very simple. It's perfectly possible to freeze different parts of a neutron star at different points in time, for example. Right. Now, a big issue, which I'm summarizing on a single slide, is well-posedness. So I have a complete set of evolution equations for the configuration gradient, for the energy density, and for the free velocity, but is it well posed? And of course, we all know that well posedness was a big problem in the bad old days of numerical relativity. So at least one would like to have strong hyperbolicity, and ideally one would like a symmetric hyperbolicity. And in fact, we can get both. So these are the evolution equations for the matter variables. It's well known in the Newtonian literature, if I add this combination of the constraints to the right-hand side, the whole thing becomes strongly hyperbolic. I can show that in the GR case as well. And I can also show that if I add further constraints on the right-hand side of the stress-energy conservation laws, then the whole thing becomes symmetric hyperbolic. And the proof is mine, but it's based on methods by Weick and Schmidt in this paper. Okay, and I will just conclude with a series of questions to the audience. So really, we would like to know, by being at this conference, what are the interesting simulations to carry out next once we really have a code? What can you tell us about the equation of state? What should we think about in terms of breaking, melting, and freezing? Something I'm quite interested in and haven't got an answer for yet, in spite of talking a lot to David, is what are the initial data for star quakes? And then also the question is, what physics should we add next? We think, but probably the most important thing is to have interfaces with elastic, between elastic and fluid matter, in other words, inside the crust, and from elastic to vacuum outside the crust. But we don't know. Perhaps there is an ocean that matters, so we don't know that. And of course, we need to add magnetic fields. So is ideal MHD good for this or not? And we probably want superfluid neutrons, and possibly we want anisotropic matter, which I haven't talked about. Okay, so any answers on any of these questions would be very welcome.
Our question.
I'd like to get a bit of a more intuitive feeling for the KAB that you introduced. And this elasticity reminds me of the old problem of a relativistically rotating bicycle wheel, which you have difficulty creating. Is that where this KAB becomes non-trivial, for example?
I'm not sure I can see the connection with the bicycle wheel. I mean, we're not trying to make an extended rigid body here. It's all perfectly local.
The theory
but the point is that when you freeze the material, you imprint the local space-time metric at that moment in time in that slicing, you know, the slicing normal to the matter. And therefore, even if the space-time is Minkowski, as long as the matter is moving relativistically, of course, you know, that changes the spatial metric seen by the co-moving observers because of the gamma factor. And therefore, if you piece together different pieces of that, the matter metric that you end up with will not be flat.
Okay, thank you.
So, yeah.
Any other questions?
So one question you mentioned about perhaps trying to match from the inside to the crust and from the crust to the outside. Is that a mass direction to take, or you could think of an alternative that would smoothly contains all regimes in the appropriate way? I mean, could you imagine a hybrid version that contains both elasticity and the fluid description, and then by looking at the right, by whatever value the density might have, you have one dominating over the other one without having to match across a hard interface.
Right. So there's two answers to that. In terms of variables, probably the easiest thing is if you just evolve the psi variables throughout, but they don't do anything in the fluid regime. You evolve them in case you want to, for example, freeze the fluid later. That's just a technical answer. The physical answer that you may want is that the limit from elastic matter to hydro is singular. So if you make the material softer and softer, so if you send the shear modulus, if you want, to zero, well, in some sense, the non-diagonal part of the stress tensor becomes smaller and smaller. That's true. But you still have got these shear shocks, and you haven't got contact discontinuities. So there's qualitative difference. In other words, if you make, say, you make the materials softer and softer, then you know, will still, as you try and shear the material, you're still building up a shear. It just takes longer to build up a stress because the material is softer. But in the end, you know, it will, you know, you will find force if you wait long enough. So really, you do need to have an interface on the ones where the fluid can slip against the elastic matter. I mean, if you're in MHD, then MHD will not allow the slip. If it's ideal MHD in both, that's frozen in both the elastic matter and the fluid. And that might actually, in a funny way, make things a little simpler. But really, this is, it's a numerical thing. I mean, it's mathematically, it's completely clear what we need to do. It's just that it's like sort of having two different equations of state or something. You have to have an interface. You probably need a level set method, and then it goes ghost fluids and so on. So that's it's a tricky numerical problem. Ian may talk more about that.
So if the velocities are small, then you can use the non-relativistic limit, right? So are there situations where the velocities of the particles are large?
Yes. I mean, if we want to simulate neutron stars, then everything will be relativistic. The gravitational field will be strong, and velocities will very easily become relativistic.
But typically, for instance, if you're looking at ions, the ions never move at velocities which are very fast, unless maybe close to mergers or something like that.
No, I'm not looking about movement of particles. I'm talking about the bulk motion. So different parts of a neutron, if a neutron star is oscillating, different parts of a neutron star can move relativistic speeds with respect to other parts.
Any other questions?
Naive question. Are there new shear moduli? Or in principle, it's the same kinds of deformation. The energy is a function of deformation.
No.
Non-relativistically.
So I remember for isotropic matter, there were these two generalized forces that I've just randomly called F1 and F2. And it turns out that F1 plus 4F2 is the usual shear modulus. And it turns out that for linear deformations, it's only ever that linear combination that comes in. So you need to look at nonlinear deformations to distinguish that by experiment between F1 and F2. But there's precisely two of them. And that just follows from the fact that matter space is three-dimensional for isotropic matter.
So this is nonlinear, but not necessarily relativistic.
That's right. So it's the same in Newtonian physics. Except I haven't really seen it there, but it must be. I mean, so there's nothing qualitatively different here in the Newtonian limit, except for the fact that in the Newtonian limit, you can assume that matter space is flat.
Any other questions? All right, let's thank Carsten again.